Our first case for argument, United States v. Ari. Mr. Martin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I represent Mr. Ari, who is one of the four appellants in this case. He's filed a joint brief with Mr. Daniels. He and Mr. Daniels had went to trial. In the time I have allotted, I'm going to try and focus on one of his individual issues. It's undisputed that the government is obligated to avoid presenting false evidence and has a duty to correct the record when false evidence appears in a record. In this case, on cross-examination during the government's direct case, Chicago Police Officer Colello was asked, after Ms. Ari had left her house, isn't it a fact she was pulled over? He answered, no, ma'am. That particular question was not phrased in terms of his awareness. He gave an affirmative, declarative answer that it was not pulled over. After Mrs. Ari's testimony, the government learned from an unknown police officer that, in fact, the car had been pulled over, that a search had occurred, a compartment specialist was called, and this was all things that Ms. Ari testified to, but when the government cross-examined her, they viewed it with great skepticism, and especially if you look at her testimony, the part about the compartment specialist, they took the position it didn't occur. So there was a credibility contest between the Chicago police officer, Mr. Colella, and Ms. Ari when the case went to the jury. In closing argument, the government at that point had not disclosed to the defense what had occurred. And if it had, it could have been stipulated that the search had occurred, that Ms. Ari was truthful, that the officer had given incorrect testimony. And instead of
that, it was more incorrect testimony than a lie. Apparently he said he didn't know that search had happened.
That is correct, Your Honor. There was no post-hearing affidavit submitted, so we really don't know what his state of mind was. It was incorrect on its face, and there was no hearing. What is somewhat peculiar was he was the team leader. He was a Chicago police officer assigned to the task force, and the officers who had conducted the search were Chicago police officers. He testified as team leader. It was his job to delegate what officers had done, and the officers who remained on the scene were Chicago police officers. But we really don't know what his state of mind was without an affidavit or a hearing, and that's one of the avenues of relief we're asking for is a hearing. In the district court's opinion, the district court treated it as if it was Officer or Agent Cooper that testified. Actually, it was Officer Colello, and the government even recognized, given that confusion, the record may not be entirely clear. As an appellate court, I realize that the principal question for this court is how Mr. Ari was prejudiced. I would note at the outset that there is a distinction in the standard of review. We discussed that in our brief. And in this case, the government says, well, there's no Brady violation. Well, there's no Brady violation. Let's look at it as a NAPIU issue, and that is where we get the beneficial standard of review. Mr. Ari was never apprehended at the scene of a drug transaction. The one day he was observed on the street, he was not stopped. No money was found in his house. No drugs were found in his house. No paraphernalia was found in his house. Government said in closing argument he was not the drug dealer of the century. Rocco, the guy that he was supposed to have supervised, we don't even know who he was. There was no
How much weight would a wife's testimony have?
Well, the wife's testimony had weight for this reason that is important, is the government argued in closing argument, you know what? We don't know if there were drugs in that house because it wasn't searched. Colella testified it wasn't searched, that she called off the search. So that's what they got that inference that they should not have gotten, that the house wasn't searched. So that's a particular weight in this case. I've seen I've used my 3 minutes, so I'll sit down.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Martin. Ms. Bell?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Samantha Bell on behalf of Antoine Daniels. I reserved 1 minute for rebuttal. I'm going to begin with Daniels' individual arguments. First, the district court erred by allowing the post-arrest statement, which was the result of an improper interrogation. Nine armed officers and agents arrived at Antoine Daniel's home at 6 o'clock in the morning for one reason, to arrest Antoine. They only had an arrest warrant, not a search warrant. They placed Daniels in handcuffs and brought him to the front of the home. At the same time, other officers did a protective sweep of the home, found Daniel's 8-year-old and 3-year-old children, and brought them to the front of the home to be with their mother. Daniels was in handcuffs. They were all gathered at the front of the home and surrounded by the officers and agents. At that moment in time, the government's task of executing an arrest warrant on Daniels was complete. At that moment in time, there was absolutely no threat to public safety. As the district court observed, the situation was about as safe as a warrant execution inside an offender's home can be. Yet, the government proceeded to question Daniels about weapons without first providing his Miranda warnings, which violated his Fifth Amendment rights.
Well, what do you mean by questioning?
Your Honors.
How many questions?
Your Honor, the government asked Daniels if there were weapons present in the home without first providing his Miranda warnings. If this court, the government is basically asking this court to create a gun exception to the Miranda rule, which is not the narrow public safety exception the Supreme Court envisioned. If this court allows the public safety exception to apply here, they'll be allowing the government to use the exception as a pretext to the Miranda rule to improperly interrogate defendants.
Well, they would have found the gun anyway, wouldn't they have?
No, Your Honor. Assuming the statement is admissible, which it is not, if they listen to the statement said there's a gun under the dresser. At that point, the government searched under the dresser, and they did not find a gun. So there would have been no probable...
So because they have an imperfect search, he should get off?
No, Your Honor.
That doesn't make any sense.
Your Honor, the government asked if...
In other words, if they'd done a thorough search, they would have found the gun, and he'd be where he is now, right?
Your Honor,
he didn't do a thorough enough search, and therefore he should escape. Is that your argument?
No, Your Honor. Daniel's statement that there was a gun under the dresser arguably created an exigent circumstance search under the dresser. It did not create an exigency or problem.
But you said they'd done a protective search, and you're not challenging that, are
you? Correct, Your Honor. They did a protective sweep of the home.
And they didn't do a good enough job, so he should walk. That's your argument. I don't see the sense of that.
Your Honor, the argument
is... So in other words, if your position prevails, when the police do a protective search, they better turn the place completely inside out.
Well, no, Your Honor. The government arrived with just an arrest warrant, yet they decided to search the home for weapons. They did not have
You're
a search warrant.
You're not challenging the protective search.
Correct, Your Honor. They did a sweep of the home.
You're asking a question.
Your Honor,
if they had done a more thorough search, which you also would not be challenging, they would have found the gun, right?
No, Your Honor, because they didn't...
No? I don't understand you.
Because they did not have probable cause.
But you said it was fine to do a protective search. That means they could look in any place small enough to have a gun in it.
Your Honor, because they had an arrest warrant, they were able to do a protective sweep of the home to see if there was a threat to public
yes,
safety.
Yes, and if they'd done a more thorough sweep, they would have found the gun.
They wouldn't have, Your Honor, because it was under bins wrapped around in cloth, and that is not what the statement said. The statement said it was under the dresser. That did not give them the right to expand that search beyond the scope.
Isn't it true that if they'd done a more thorough search, they would have found the gun?
Perhaps, Your Honor. However, they did not have the right to do that more.
If they ransacked the house completely, they would have found the gun.
Your Honor, if we want to give the government...
Would they not have?
They may have, Your Honor, but we don't want...
They may have. If they ransacked the house, they'd find the gun, wouldn't they?
Sure, Your Honor, but we don't want to grant the government the opportunity to just arrive at a suspect's home.
You said a protective search was fine. It just wasn't thorough enough.
Yes, Your Honor. I see I've gone into my time. I just want to add that Officer Coleman's interpretation of the coded language violated Rule 704B.
Why?
Thank you. Your Honor, I see my time is up. May I have
leave to answer? Oh, why would I ask you a question and not let you answer it?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason his testimony violated Rule 704B is because he transformed from an experienced observer to a mind reader.
How should the courts deal with code?
Your Honor, this court has held that that experts can testify as to generally what coded language is used for. That was not the case here. Here, Officer Coleman said that these drug dealers use these words to talk about heroin, and that took the decision.
I don't understand you. What's the difference between testifying about code words and saying these code words therefore mean, you know, heroin.
Your Honor, the difference is that because he looked at the transcripts and said that these are the code words that these defendants are using, it took the jury out of the hand. Without that testimony, for all we know, the jury could have concluded that R.A. was talking about one drug, Daniels was talking about another. But by testifying as to what the code of language meant, it took that decision out of the jury's hand.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Bell.
Honors.
McGowan?
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Andrew McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Jerome Murray. The main issue in this appeal is whether Mr. Murray's role in the case was an organizer, leader, or a supervisor, manager. Mr. Murray has also raised two related issues, arguments. The district court used information from the trial that without notice to Mr. Murray before the sentencing that the district court was intending to. The trial was of a co-defendant. And the other issue is simply the district court didn't sufficiently explain its reasons for the finding. Unless there are any questions about these very thoroughly briefed issues, I intend briefly to address the district court's comments at sentencing as an indication of that the sentence would be different if the sentencing guidelines, or at least there's an argument that the sentence would be different if the district court had found lower guidelines. The argument in this case really affects only one level. However, this level results in a guideline range of over 2 years difference at the high end. The district court sentenced him to 262 months. However, if Mr. Murray is correct and wins in this appeal, the guideline range would go down to 235. The district court's comments, although they justified the sentence of 262 months, didn't indicate otherwise that the district court thought that the sentence of 262 months was the appropriate sentence outside of the guideline. As a result, we believe that if Mr. Murray is successful, there's a good basis to believe that Mr. Murray would get a lower sentence on a resentencing. Unless there are any questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McGowan.
Thank you.
Mr. Wraith?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Douglas Rath. I'm representing Julius Statham in this case. The argument I want to focus on is the two-level enhancement for the gun possession. When the agents searched the home, they found a safe. Inside the safe, they found drugs. No, strike that. They did not find drugs. They found firearms and they found money. The district court then decided that was a sufficient reason to enhance it and apply a two-level enhancement. This court has said very specifically in the case of Botham, which I cited in the brief, that what you really want to find is somewhere in the house there are drugs and firearms. That is the presumptive connection. There is no drugs that were found anywhere in this house. In fact, there was a thorough search of the entire house, and there was nothing found whatsoever. In the government's brief, the government argues simply the fact that $20,000 was found in the safe was enough to presume that this was drug proceeds, and therefore the enhancement should apply. Further, if you look at the PSR, which, again, I make reference to in the brief, it indicates that there is nothing to suggest that Julius Statham was ever in possession of a gun to protect any drug transaction.
Isn't the inference that $20,000 was drug money a good inference?
Judge?
Pretty odd to have $20,000 in cash. Is this some very wealthy person?
Judge, I'm sure judges can draw an inference, but there is the cases that this court have handed down have simply said so long as there are drugs found in the house.
But if you have money, which is obviously drug proceeds, it's a huge amount of cash. Yeah, one would want to have a gun in order to protect all this money.
This court has not found.
Well, what's wrong with that logic? I don't understand.
Judge, I don't think
the gun was for.
Judge, many people in this country have guns to protect themselves.
Wasn't it your burden to show that it was clearly improbable that that was associated with the drug activity?
That's what the application note says, that it would be clearly improbable.
And the evidence is $20,000 in cash, drug involvement, and two guns in the safe, right?
Yes.
How does that show it's clearly improbable that that was related to drug activity?
Because there is nothing in the house whatsoever.
Yeah, but you need to have an alternative story as to why the gun was in the safe with the $20,000.
Judge, as I say, it may have been simply designed to protect the $20,000. There is no evidence whatsoever.
Right.
There was
right.
no
to
evidence.
To protect your drug money. Well, that's using a gun in connection with drug trafficking.
Judge, there is no evidence whatsoever that nothing came out of the sentencing hearing or the plea that suggested that $20,000 was drug money.
Oh, come on now. What do you think it was?
Judge,
What business is this person in that he would have $20,000?
Judge, I can only tell you.
No, answer my question. What is the evidence of another possible source for the $20,000 besides drug trafficking?
Judge, I have no...
Is there any evidence of some other source for this money?
No, there is no evidence. Thank you.
Ms. Guerin?
May it please the Court, Hallie Guerin on behalf of the United States. The first argument that I wanted to address was the one that Mr. Martin started with regarding the NAPIU issue. There's two clarification points that I wanted to raise based on questions from Your Honor. The first is that in terms of the weight of the wife's evidence, the fact of whether or not there was a search of her car had no real material effect in any way on her testimony and her credibility. And that is actually the main point that the government wants to raise. It doesn't matter that Judge Guzman mixed up the identities of the two officers because ultimately this was not material. And the reason why is this. The wife got up there and her main testimony was in support of the defendant's argument that he ran a music business. This is a point the government never disputed. On closing argument, in rebuttal, the government said, yes, we're not saying that he didn't also run a music business. So her credibility on the defendant's main defense was unaffected. The other area in which her credibility was unaffected was that the search of the house was not done. She explained the circumstances of how the search of how the officers came to the home and that she ultimately withdrew her consent to have the search and the search stopped. This was entirely consistent with Officer Colello's testimony. So again, the only point of contention was whether or not this search of the car happened. And going back to a question that Your Honors asked, Officer Colello's testimony, just to clarify, was not that no search happened. There were follow-up questions. It was that to his knowledge, no search happened. And that's an important point, too. And in closing argument on rebuttal, when the prosecutor was stating, did a search of the car happen? I don't know, maybe. She moved on to the point that no drugs were found in the house because there was no search of the house. This was rebutting the point that was raised in closing argument by the defendant. And her statement was showing, again, that whether or not there was a search of the car was completely irrelevant to the issues at trial. It is a collateral issue. There was never any evidence presented that the defendant used his wife's car for drugs. There was evidence that no actual search of the house was ultimately completed. I also want to address the point of Officer Colello's knowledge. At the time in which he was the team leader, he was a task force officer assigned to FBI. He was also a Chicago police officer, but his role was as a task force officer and as a team leader. He was not there at the time that the search of the car happened. He had gone with the defendant to the DEA station, and the purpose, the main purpose, if you read Officer Colello's entire testimony, is actually a voice identification of the defendant. That's the purpose. The discussion about how the arrest occurred just gets to the point of why Officer Colello heard the defendant's voice. If there's no questions from Your Honors on this point, I'm going to move on to some of the other issues that were raised. The defendant, Daniels, also raised the argument about the search of the house, and I think that Your Honor had raised some important points that I also wanted to address. Going into what was discussed about this protective search and the fact that should defendant Daniels get off from sort of an unthorough first protective search, I want to highlight the fact that Daniels was actually found in the bedroom. That's where the arrest took place. So in keeping with that, a protective search could have uncovered that gun initially. In addition, the public safety exception should encompass this situation. And the reason why is because the officers and the agents going to that house knew ahead of time that Daniels had convictions for guns and that he had convictions and arrests for guns and drugs. And there is a Seventh Circuit opinion that discusses the fact that that in itself creates a presumption of a safety issue. The officers and agents did an initial brief search of the house in looking for Daniels. It was not thorough in any way. There could have been other people there. They were then going to be leaving the house with Daniels, leaving the wife and the children. It was important to ask whether or not guns were present for a public safety issue. And then once they learned, in fact, that a gun was present, they could not, in keeping with public safety, leave that house knowing that there was a gun that the children could get access to.
Were the children restrained when they were in the living room?
No, Your Honor. There's no evidence in the record.
Daniels was.
Daniels was the only one, according to the record, that was restrained.
So his wife was not either.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you about this, the coded word argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
I haven't read the transcript here, but I assume that if this is a typical conspiracy, drug conspiracy, you have people on the inside who have testified. Did you have that in this case?
No, Your Honor. There were no cooperators who testified at this trial. But to clarify the evidence that the expert provided, he initially started off and he said, I did not review the record in this case. I do not know the allegations or the facts here. The only thing I know are these transcripts that I've reviewed. So it was very clear that he had no specific knowledge in any way of the defendant's mindset. He testified that in general, drug dealers do use coded language.
I know we always allow that or generally allow that in conspiracy cases, and there's conspiracy counts here. But do you see any problem with that if on these telephone counts?
Your Honor, I don't see a problem with that. And the reason why is because there still is an additional step that needs to be taken in terms of the jury assessing the coded language and what they mean. And that additional step is the context of those conversations, how those coded words are being used. Are they being used to arrange a drug deal, or are they being used to just discuss drugs in general? I think that there is still that step that leaves room for the jury to make the ultimate conclusion on the guilt or innocence of the defendants. And I think that it's actually important to look at some of the case law that's out there. Our circuit just asks whether or not, basically whether or not the testimony still left to the jury the task of determining the ultimate question of guilt.
Yeah, but see, here, on the telephone counts, it seems to me, you charge somebody with using a telephone to facilitate a drug transaction. And the tape of the telephone conversation is that, hypothetically, John wants to get 6 grapefruits delivered tomorrow. And then you put an expert on, an undercover officer or something, and he says, well, grapefruit means a kilo of heroin. Aren't you then, in effect, telling the jury that that's almost directing a verdict?
I think, again,
I understand it in the context of a conspiracy case that testimony is is always admissible, but it seems like a drug cut on a telephone comp, there might be some problems.
Your Honor, I understand the question, and I think that it goes back to the elements of that telephone count. One of the elements of that telephone count, which the jury was instructed on, was not just that this was whether or not they were facilitating any drug deal. It was whether or not they were facilitating the drug deal that was set out in count one. And the instructions themselves actually say count one, which is the conspiracy count. And so for the jury to decide that this particular telephone call was facilitating the drug deal in count one, there is still that room from the coded language. So if they interpreted, if you had expert testimony that the coded language is about drugs, the jury still needs to take that step to determine whether or not that phone conversation is about the drug deal related to count one. And I think that that's where the testimony on coded language allows for sufficient room even in a telephone count.
So what if you didn't have a count one, a conspiracy count in this case? All you had was a one count indictment charging using a telephone to facilitate a drug transaction.
I still think that, again, it goes down to context. Turning to some of the things that I outlined in my brief, one thing that I thought was very interesting was the Badger opinion, which talks about whether or not they're serious about the drug deal or they're just sort of talking and not really having taken that substantial step. And again, I think context plays a very important part in that analysis, which is that are they just sort of saying, hey, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we got together and did a drug deal, or are they actually talking seriously about money, negotiations, things like that, which really take it up a level into the fact that a drug deal was facilitated through the use of a phone, as opposed to they're just discussing the possibility and they're not taking that substantial step. Your Honor, do you have further questions on that issue?
I do, but I'm not going to ask them.
Okay. I do want to point out, one thing I do want to point out about the coded word use is that under the briefs of the defendants, they discuss this necessarily follows standard from the Third Circuit. I want to point out that this is not a test that applies to this situation. It seems to be not to be used as exact language. The case that necessarily followed came from was a Ninth Circuit case that also sort of interchangeably uses the words necessarily compels and necessarily implies. When you think about it, from any relevant evidence, it will necessarily follow that the defendant is guilty. If you get up there and you have the defendant's confession, from there it will necessarily follow that the defendant is guilty. That's too broad of a standard, and I don't believe that that was the intention of the Ninth Circuit or the Third Circuit in its use. And in fact, the Third Circuit that cites that necessarily followed language also distinguishes that particular case, which was involving, I believe, a psychiatrist in that situation, from a case in which coded language was interpreted just like this case, where an expert read the transcripts and provided an interpretation of that specific coded language in there. Turning to Mr. Statham's case, with regard to the drug quantity, the use of the gun, $20,000, actually more than $20,000, was found in a safe. He is charged with 1 kilo of cocaine in this particular drug conspiracy. $20,000, or about $21,000, actually equals the cost of a kilo of cocaine. I think that it is obvious that from the $20,000, a very specific amount, a large amount, but also an amount that goes along with a kilo of cocaine, and the two guns in a safe, of all places, together in a safe, something that you're trying to guard and protect, shows that this gun was used in the facilitation of the drug crimes. And in terms of Mr. Murray's discussions, I think that the evidence shows in this case that it is clear that he was a leader. A couple of things that I wanted to address from his reply brief is that In the government's laying out of how the CWs in the complaint could be corroborated, that was to show the reliability of the CWs so that you can then use all of what the CWs say, because some of what they said you've been able to corroborate. It demonstrates the reliability as a whole, and that is why that testimony those statements would then be reliable. If Your Honors do not have further questions, I'll sit down.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Fearn. So is there a rebuttal from any of the defendants? Anyone? No? Yes, go ahead, Mr. Martin.
I'll just take 1 minute, the court, please. I just want to point out that July 19th, the day of Ari's arrest, was charged in the indictment as being relevant under the conspiracy charge. Colello did testify to voice ID, but he also testified that there was no search, and there was a credibility contest on that point between him and Mrs. Ari. Mrs. Ari did testify about the music business, but she also testified how the home was searched and how the car was searched, and she was cross-examined at length about the car search. And I just asked, and I didn't hear the government answer, I don't understand why this information wasn't disclosed to the defense when it could have been used. On the expert testimony issue, I'd note that the calls that were interpreted went to the delivery count two. The instructions might have said it goes to conspiracy.
I don't understand your argument about that. Suppose someone says in Spanish, you know, I murdered my gerbil or something, and then a translator explains to the jury, well, what he said was, in Spanish, said he murdered his gerbil.
Well, in Spanish...
Is there anything wrong with that... With that testimony?
I wouldn't think so, because in Spanish you definitely have an interpretation that it's like mass.
This is druggish, right? I mean, they have their own vocabulary, and someone has to interpret it for the jury.
But it's not like math, where in every case $50 is 50 grams of heroin.
I understand you. It's a private language, and it has to be translated. And I don't see what difference it is whether he translates a phone conversation from Spanish to English or from drug to English.
Because it was an opinion. It wasn't going back to something that's scientific or it could be objectively...
I understand. What's scientific about translation? There are some people who know two languages. They can tell you what a word in one language means in another. And that's what these police officers do. They tell you that, you know, in Judge Evans' example, grapefruit means heroin. What's the difference?
On the telephone counts, that's all there was.
Who cares? It's all it was. The jury has to understand what these people are saying in English. So someone has to tell them what the English equivalent of these words is, right?
And that's fine, but for Rule 704, it says the expert...
It's fine. Of course it's fine. How else could a jury decide a case like this if there's no one to tell them what these words mean?
Well, we're just going by the language of Rule 704, Judge.
Well, it doesn't make sense, though, right? Doesn't make any sense.
No, right, 704.
Does it make sense to you?
Well, when it's a telephone count, because there's nothing else but the opinion.
Telephone count or anything. The jury has to be told what words mean. Otherwise, they can't interpret. They can't understand the telephone call if they know what the words mean.
Okay.
Whether it's a foreign language or some private code, I don't know what difference that should make. What if you had this espionage case, and you've got people, writing in cipher? Can't you have an expert to translate the cipher into English?
If there was an objective basis and there was other evidence.
By objective basis. There are experts in languages, there are experts in cipher, and there are experts in this drug lingo.
In your example, Your Honor, with Spanish, I mean, we can all go back and find out what the interpreted word means. In this, it's just the law enforcement officer's opinion.
Well, where do you want to go? To the dictionary of drug language?
There is no such dictionary.
Well, then how do you... So in other words, you think these people, by using a private code, insulate themselves from prosecution?
No, I'm not saying that. It's up to the jury to determine.
Well, how can the jury determine something if no one tells them what the words mean?
Well, if they're given an opinion on the ultimate issue, that's taboo. Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, well, thank you very much to the defendant's lawyers who were appointed, and, of course, the defenders, too. We thank them for their efforts on behalf of their clients. Next case for